Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea. I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning into the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare, policy, and technology. My guest today is Dr. Jennifer Yeager. She's a senior medical director at Health EC and previously served as director, Infectious Disease Bureau and Population Health for the Boston Public Health Commission. Dr. Yeager brings clinical oversight to Health EC's population health management programs, of course, now with a major focus on COVID-19. She functions at the intersection of healthcare policy, clinical care, and data analytics, translating that knowledge into actionable insights for healthcare organizations to improve patient care and health outcomes at reduced cost. Dr. Yeager, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I recently read an article you wrote entitled The Intersection of Population Health and Public Health in a Pandemic, and our conversation today could not be more timely. I think that for professionals and providers who work in this area of population health, the COVID-19 pandemic may well turn out to be the largest and most intense battle experience of their professional life. In many ways, it seems like people with your background, this is what you've trained for all along. And so here we are in the middle of it. So we don't have the 3 or 4 hours I really want to talk about this, but let's just kind of jump right into it. And I guess at the highest level, could you talk a little bit about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on public health populations?
Absolutely. I think as you've mentioned, COVID-19 is not anything that anyone here alive in their adult years, at least, has seen before. And I was talking with somebody recently who said the word unprecedented is just so overused now. But the truth is that what we're seeing now is unprecedented and impacts every aspect of life that we know, from the global economy to, as you mentioned, social determinants, which broadly speaking includes mental health and substance use and personal violence and safety. And we're not just seeing a confusion as in terms of what are the risk populations, or what are the presenting signs, or what are going to be the long-term consequences of this never seen before virus, but we're seeing a manifestation or an augmenting, I think, of problems that have been there all along. And here I'm referring to racial disparities and health inequality. Why is it that persons of color, Black and Hispanic individuals, have greater rates of infection and greater rates of death of COVID or due to COVID than white individuals? And that's not necessarily something related to the virus itself, but of the larger systems in place. And we need to, as we're trying to figure out what that new normal is, there are certain things we shouldn't go back to. We need to actually change, I think, the way we do business in medicine and how we are walking through the world and interacting with our communities. And we need to make substantive changes in that as well. So, you said, could we have 2 or 3 hours? Boy, we could have 5 hours and still not even scratch the surface. Yeah, but those are some of the issues I think are most important.
You touched on it, and it's something that I've talked about with folks a lot in the last couple of months. Some of these social determinants that have to do with those groups that are in positions where they can work from home. Some mm-hmm. groups, their social determinants where they cannot work at home. So certainly a greater risk there. Some people much easier because of their social, I'm not even sure what to call it, but social positioning. It's much easier to stay apart from people if you're in a large apartment building where there's a lot of people. That's much different than you live in the suburbs where everybody has a large lawn. So,
exactly.
Things like that. And then if there is an economic crisis, some people have a buffer or a cushion. Some people don't. So some people are going to be impacted much more just by the economics of this.
Exactly. Exactly. And as you mentioned, you can look at socioeconomic standing, but we can look at race and ethnicity. And it's been said before many times that zip code is a greater determinant of your health and well-being than your genetic code. And unfortunately, as you said, the individuals who are in professions that are considered essential, like store clerks, are often individuals of color who are required to be working face-to-face with individuals. And if those stores aren't providing masks or aren't providing new masks consistently, then they're at risk for being exposed and then for having a more severe infection. And the possibility of saying, no, I can't do this. I have kids at home, or I have an elderly parent at home I need to take care of. They don't have an option of saying, I'm at risk for losing this job. That's okay. I can take that hit because I have a buffer. So you said it really well, that there are a lot of different factors that place Black and brown individuals at much greater risk. And an interesting thing I was reading recently is that it is looking like a large minority of individuals who have COVID infection may end up having long-term cardiac impacts, cardiac abnormalities moving forward, and even without symptoms. So we're looking at a large number of individuals who are already at risk because of their underlying comorbidities, now having even greater long-term consequences. And that's from a health technology and care coordination standpoint emphasizes the importance of how do we move forward then in making sure that we're delivering high quality, effective care to a large number of individuals, especially in the backdrop of where healthcare systems now are financially being impacted and may not be able to recover as quickly as we would like. And there will definitely be the need there moving forward.
Now, I know you've had quite an experience in Boston with outbreaks related to hepatitis A, and certainly some social determinants were involved there. Is there any way you can compare that experience to the impact of social issues on the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, certainly. Social distancing is one of the biggest issues that we see with hepatitis A as well as with COVID. It's not spread through the respiratory droplets, hepatitis A, but it is through close personal contact and in areas where sanitation is poor. So looking at homeless individuals, whether they're sheltered or unsheltered, and then encampments where we see a lot of injecting drug use. And those populations are vulnerable. They have untreated, unmanaged comorbidities. Their nutrition is poor. Their access to healthcare is poor. They are silent majority of cases, at least from hepatitis A, that were not even being addressed until we realized, in fact, that there was an outbreak. And we, meaning various communities that that suffered from hepatitis A outbreaks across the country. So one of the problems is, of course, that when one person within an encampment has hepatitis A, it spreads through the entire encampment, and then they disperse. And so you have a large number of individuals that you can't find and that don't necessarily trust the healthcare system, but don't really access it very well. And it was very difficult to get on top of it until we went into the community and created relationships and trust with these communities and let them know we're here to help you and provide the help to them, bringing it to them. And I think that the analogy here with COVID and social distancing or social isolation that we need to bring care to them. So the advent of telehealth is so important, and touch points. We have, when folks come to the doctor, they're not just coming to get their blood pressure checked, but it's a social interaction. You know, they're talking about their kids and their grandkids, and they're showing pictures, and they're chatting with the person who checks them in and the nurse. And there are multiple touch points where if something is happening, if somebody isn't acting themselves, if they have bruises, if they seem depressed, you have opportunities to see them and to effect change, to say, what's going on? Maybe we need to refer you. Is there a problem? And we lose that here now with COVID. And so, again, we need to bring care, both personal care and healthcare, to this population. And that's, I think that's the biggest analogy.
You know, there's you've kind of touched on it a little bit there. It seems like certainly since March, a lot of healthcare, whether it's wellness or elective things or visits to doctor, are being put off or delayed. So there's a backlog of this, and that's probably going to have a long tail in terms of health outcomes for everybody, just about.
Now, absolutely.
You know, one thing that we talk about is for COVID-19 is testing. There's not there's recommendations, I guess, from CDC, but there's not a national testing framework. And so to health departments and state by state kind of do what they do. But the idea of gathering social determinants of health, that actual data, I know you want to pull that data from any available source, like you say, zip codes, other kind of things, and analyze that data for actionable insights, identify those high-risk patients and figure out how to take care of them. This is certainly will not be done I'm not aware of it being done anyway on a national level. So it's going to be kind of on a best practices to identify best practices. Mm-hmm. And in your article that I referenced, there's eight steps to take that really, to me, cover this whole territory really well, to identify persons who are at risk and things like that. So if you don't mind, I think these are so important, we should go through each one of these eight. And
sure.
And the first is that look for opportunity density by targeting zip codes where underserved populations reside. And you kind of referenced this earlier. And so when you talk about underserved populations, are you talking about zip codes with lower incomes, density, high rates of certain diagnoses, demographics, age, those kind of things?
Yes, exactly. Elderly, where somebody's living in a building where they need to climb two or three flights of stairs and take two forms of transportation, public transportation, to get to the doctor's office. Well, this person can't take a bus and a subway any longer. They're not taking Ubers either, and they may not be able to walk to their to a local community health center or emergency department, let alone getting to their, you know, their own physician. And so we look at elderly and infirmed, and these are folks that are particular high risk groups for COVID specifically. And so the hardest hit are also the hardest impacted from not being able to access healthcare. They also may not be IT savvy, so they may not even have a home computer or really know how to use it. And they certainly aren't on their smartphones all the time. So they have impaired access. And in terms of being able to get refills of their medications or food or as again, even just social interactions, these are also impaired access to necessary items and facets of life that they are going to be impaired as a result of not having. And so looking at where these individuals are from a standpoint of that's where you want to be. If you have limited resources, you want to have the biggest bang for your buck. Again, look for populations, areas, neighborhoods that are most underserved. And again, because we know that lack of social distancing increases the likelihood of spread, you're more likely to find transmission in these areas as well.
Well, and then once you're targeting those zip codes, it looks like, and this is steps 2 and 3 in your article, it looks like that it's important to develop some type of risk scoring modality to perhaps identify those most at-risk individuals in these zip codes. And so what do those risk scoring tools look like?
So at first, we began with the known populations from the experience in other countries. Again, our experience is a little bit different. We were seeing a tremendous amount of racial and ethnic disparities that weren't necessarily seen in other countries. But we started there, which is folks over the age of 65, particularly those over the age of 80, and those with particular types of underlying or chronic conditions, particularly diabetes, obesity, smoking, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and we thought COPD and possibly asthma as well. Although, interestingly, we're not really seeing, at least at my last view, a significant increase in individuals who have cystic fibrosis. So it's not just all lung disorders, but certain types of lung disorders. And in the beginning, we also thought that we would be seeing what is pretty traditional. Folks who are immune suppressed would be at greatest risk for having the severe infection. But one of the things that we're seeing as a problem associated with COVID, in fact, what is causing severe disease, is the body's own immune response to the infection. And so folks who are actually somewhat immune suppressed may, I don't want to say protected, but don't seem to be at the same effect as we would see with other types of infections where somebody who's immune suppressed is at highest risk. So we start with what was known, and then we add to this various prospective risk scores that are pretty well established depending on the type of population, whether that's the Johns Hopkins or whether it's HCC scoring or the C3 scores used for cancer patients. So we can add that along, looking at prospectively who is at highest risk based on what their underlying conditions are now, how they are likely to access healthcare moving forward. And then we can add some frailty indices as well, and then look at recent emergency room or inpatient hospitalization use, as well as multiple medications and such. So we take as much data as we can. As you mentioned, I work for HealthEC, and we have an incredible data analytics platform that allows us to bring together claims data and clinical data and pharmacy data, lab data, that brought all together gives us a longitudinal and a very complete picture of an individual at risk, and we can pull on a number of different data sources. There are astute and well-funded health departments across the country that can have access to some of these data. They don't typically get claims data, and there are a number of hospitals and such that can get claims data, but clinical data as well, and they sometimes there'll be a delay. So whatever access you have, I say use. Whatever data you have access to, use, and whatever service you're using, you know, draw on their expertise and try to pull together as many different data points as you can so that you can determine who's at greatest risk.
And that whole area, and again, this was the next area of your discussion, your article, really kind of got into the area of data gathering, data aggregating, data analysis, to get as much data as possible in, normalize it, and then kind of screen down with finer and finer screens to get the most at-risk individuals.
Yes.
And then that kind of brings us, I guess, to step 5 here, is once that subset of the subset has been identified, focus on them. So in what ways would the healthcare network support system focus on those patients initially?
So the first is identifying who your highest risk patients are. And mm-hmm. and just to sort of level set, and I know I just mentioned this, so folks who are 65 and above, so that's your entire Medicare population. And then anybody with multiple comorbidities, well, that's your Medicaid population. And there are just too many individuals from any one practice or hospital to say, okay, we'll target this 80,000 individuals. And so that's the reason I say for pulling in all of the different data sources that you can and doing some analysis based on the algorithm that we designed. We were able to take the entire patient population and whittle it down to the top 10%. And interestingly enough, of those who would be at highest risk for not just infection, but a severe infection, there was an oncology practice, a large multi-state oncology practice that we work with, and they independently validated our process. They identified their high-risk individuals, some folks that they know, and we identified all of those plus an additional 25% that they were able to reach out to, some of whom were already suffering from COVID. And so they were really appreciative that they could, you know, just take this list and run with it. And so once armed with the list, what you want to do is be able to, whether you have a care manager or care coordinator, or whether it's a community health worker or a nurse, is to just start calling individuals first on the telephone. And we then designed, and there were several out there, we designed a simple seven-question questionnaire or survey to identify whether, in fact, you were currently demonstrating symptoms that needed care. And that would be either due to COVID or not due to COVID. So one of the unfortunate consequences of social distancing and folks trying to do right by our frontline staff and not go to the hospital when they didn't need to, so that the hospital and emergency departments weren't being overwhelmed. We're staying home when they shouldn't have. And there was some studies that were done that identified a number of patients who were being called, had called EMTs too late, and a significant increase in the number of individuals who were dead upon the arrival of the EMTs. And so we want to make sure that the folks who need access, whether it's due to COVID or not, if they're having a heart attack, they need to go to the hospital. And it's more important that they get to the hospitals. And so our survey was designed to identify those folks who were in distress and needed brick and mortar care right away. And then you have time to, once you have that identified and you have them handled and are referred, then you need to identify those folks who were at risk for over the next day or two, maybe getting worse, because we know that there was a fast ramp up. And so we wanted those folks to be put into a queue so that the following day, they had a touch point. They had another callback. The day after that, they had another callback. And so that workflow was designed as part of our chronic care management program. But it can be, again, we have a platform that is set up to do this automatically and generates alerts and problem lists and interventions that are triggered and can support the workflow of the nurses and care coordinators. But in fact, armed with a list of high-risk patients, anybody can just start calling and keeping a spreadsheet, they could, you know, identify who needed what. And then the next thing as on this list was, you know, identify what the immediate social needs are as well. Are they at risk for, are they suffering from depression? Is there increased substance use? And are they safe? And so we saw very early on increases in domestic violence, in child abuse, and we want to make sure that we're not missing that, you know, those critical issues as well. And so that's part of an assessment that we have built into our platform, various other social determinants such as food insecurity and housing stability and various other issues and depression scales. But whatever it is that you have access to within your own setting, you want to make sure that you're assessing for these immediate needs. And then the third point would be those folks who, yes, they're at risk. Now you need to just educate them. Stay at home. What does social distancing mean? How do you do infection control in your home? How are you going to get access, you know, get your medications refilled? And so the still necessary issues, but not ones that require immediate addressing and not ones that need brick and mortar services. And then again, setting up a workflow with your team in order to ensure the seamless and continuity of care that they require. So those would be the three groups that we identified within our survey. And then again, putting it into your workflow so that once you've made your touch, you know, you've reached out to them once, they're in a queue for being able to be followed up as they need to be.
You know, this process that you just described of that Healthy C has built, one thing I really like about it, it is focused initially on responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's also going to pick up all the other healthcare things because there's going to be those most at-risk individuals who are going to be contacted to see what the issues are. And then other kind of issues, whether it has to do with medications or diet or a change in their vitals or symptoms will be picked up. And then, so it sounds like a real team-based approach where as needs are identified, those needs are directed to whether it's, you know, nurses or social workers or to physicians or mid-level providers.
Yes, and I will say that, you know, I brought with me my expertise in infectious diseases and epidemiology and clinical care, but Healthy C has been embedded in the value-based healthcare world for quite some time. And so their program really lent itself to addressing this particular crisis and the next crisis. And so that, I think, is thinking about the Victor Hugo quote that says, nothing is as powerful as an idea whose time has come. And so looking at value-based contracting, looking at alternative payment models, it's sad that we need to incentivize, and I'm a physician, so I can say this, that we need to incentivize doctors to do the right thing and provide high quality care, you know, the right kind of care at the right place for the right person. But this is what is I hope will be moving forward, is an increased emphasis on these alternative payment models that rely on strong population health and care coordination and care management that is preventing the worst case scenario as opposed to addressing it once it's there. And that's something that is Healthy C's strong suit. I mean, that's its sandbox. So we were a natural fit for one another, I will say.
Yeah, and that's this whole idea of how successful this approach will be, there could have been, I'm sure there've been lots of experiments and attempts to prove or disprove this approach to healthcare. But in this case, it was forced upon us by the pandemic. And so this is a response. And so the real data will come out. Well, unbelievably, Dr. Yeager, our time is totally up. I can't believe how it kind of went by so fast. To our audience, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest, Dr. Jennifer Yeager of Health EC. Dr. Yeager, thanks for coming aboard today.
Thank you for having me. It was a lovely time talking with you.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.